we've had to roll in other chairs to do this. All right, well, it's my great honor to introduce Ed Green, who's recently joined us as a faculty member here at Santa Cruz. And every time I go to a meeting, I always brag enormously about recruiting you to Santa Cruz. Many of you who are involved in the Neanderthal Project know how exciting it is, and it's an incredible opportunity to look at our own evolutionary history from the perspective of now it's our closest relative. We've been talking about chimp as our closest relative for a long time, and really this is replacing chimp in a dramatic way from the genomics perspective. So Ed has done an amazing work in many areas, RNA, great stuff on RNA at when you were at Berkeley, and a lot of other things with Svante, but now he's a media star here with this spectacular recent work on the Neanderthals, so we're greatly honored that you're going to reveal us with this talk.
Thanks, David. I was expecting that this meeting is going to be kind of informal, but with so many people, it's hard to get the mindset of informality and still talk to such a big group, but that's what I'm shooting for. And if you can help me by stopping and asking questions along the way if anything is unclear. So the goal here is I'm going to give a little bit of background and kind of explain what we have done thus far, but hopefully spend a lot of time, and the main goal is to talk about how we might use the Neanderthal genome to understand recent human evolution. Some of this was outlined in the paper, and I'll kind of show what was done there and maybe even brainstorm a little bit about how this could be refined and turned into a more powerful tool for finding the recent episodes of positive selection that aren't really visible by other means using Neanderthal data. Okay, so by way of background, as David said, the Neanderthals are our closest relatives. They just happen to be extinct. On the left here is a reconstruction, chimeric really reconstruction of Neanderthal fossil. Most of the body here comes from Feldhofer, the type specimen Neanderthal on the head. Now I need some technical support for the laser. The head comes from this loft there. See, or maybe I can just. I don't really need a laser pointer. You know what I'm talking about. On the left, there's the Neanderthal, and you can see he looks really similar to the guy on the right, which is you and me, modern human. So these are morphologically really similar. There might be one on here.
I have a question. Do you have your slides available online or
I don't. I could put them online if there's interest in that. Wait until you see them first and then decide whether you really want them. In general,
there's people that are actually watching them.
Ah, what are they seeing?
They can't see anything.
Well,
they're listening.
You can do that later.
Okay. Who is listening?
Rachel Hart.
Okay, like people who can't attend the meeting, it's
yeah.
Sort of
yeah.
Got it. Okay. Hi, Rachel. Okay. So those are morphologically they're very similar to us, as you can see. The crania of Neanderthal on top, you can compare to the modern human crania, and this is just kind of to give you a sense of how similar they are. Experts can point out lots of differences between the two. There's a heavy brow ridge and something at the back of the cranium called the occipital bun, and in general their bones were thicker than ours, but if you compare to chimp cranium, for example, those guys have a much smaller brain case. Neanderthal actually has on average, a larger brain case than we have, and inferred from this is that they had even larger brains than we have, slightly larger, although the range of brain size within humans and Neanderthals is really big. So there are some Neanderthals that have smaller brains than some humans and vice versa. But brain size is not something that we differ from to Neanderthals, although we do differ to all the other great apes and all primates. Humans are kind of outside the line on this encephalization quotient, the ratio of cranium size to the rest of the body. But we are outside of the line with Neanderthals. They also had a really big brain. So this is one interpretation of the human fossil record. You can see here we are. We came into existence anatomically, modern humans, about 130,000 years ago, and Neanderthals about 200,000 years ago. And for most of the time that we have been around, they have also been around here. This is shown time on the x-axis, and the basic atmospheric conditions here. These are ice ages, as inferred by CO2 in the atmosphere, as inferred by how much CO2 is in the these ice cores. And you can see those guys lived mostly through two ice ages. Didn't make it to the current interglacial period that we have been enjoying for about 10,000 years. They went extinct about 30,000 years ago. But for most of the time that they were around, we were around, and vice versa. So most of our history has been sharing the earth with Neanderthals. They haven't been here for 30,000 years, so we have not seen one, but that's kind of the exception rather than the rule. Geographically, their fossils are known to have been recovered mostly in Europe and the Middle East, and very recently a fossil from Siberia, this Aklonikov, was shown to be Neanderthal because it has the Neanderthal haplotype from the mitochondria. A lot of the early work in ancient DNA, and specifically in Neanderthals, was focused on the mitochondria for this very simple fact that it exists in such high copy number per cell. There are about 1,000 copies of this in any cell, whereas there are only 2 copies of the nuclear genome. So if you hope to recover and sequence some fragment, it's a good strategy to go for the mitochondria because you push the odds a lot in your favor. There's so many more starting molecules of this, it's a better chance that you'll recover something. And most of the early work was just PCR of some part of the D-loop or the hypervariable region, hoping to get some intact fragment out of the bone that you could amplify up and then say something about the phylogeny of Neanderthal compared to the rest of humans. Mitochondria are limited, as you probably know. You get your mitochondria from your mom, who got it from her mom, who got it from her mom. So men are completely outside of the realm of what's important when it comes to mitochondria. The mitochondria of men are a complete dead end, so they'll never pass it on to anybody. So if you get data from mitochondria, what you're interrogating is just this maternal lineage here of your own genealogy. Whereas the nuclear genome is inherited in roughly equal proportion from every ancestor that you have at any depth of your own personal genealogy. So nuclear genome sequence is much more useful for saying something about genetic relatedness. Mitochondria is really limited, so that had been a goal for a long time to get nuclear genome sequence from Neanderthal. We knew what the story was from the mitochondria. Neanderthals fall completely outside the variation that one sees in modern humans. There's a specific haplotype that is seen in all Neanderthals that have been sequenced to date. So there are lots of differences that fall on this lineage that all Neanderthals have and no humans have. And likewise, there are a lot of differences that fall here that all humans have that no Neanderthals have. So what this tells us is that no one's mother or mother's mother or mother's mother's mother or nobody who's directly on just the maternal lineage is a Neanderthal from anybody living now, because thousands of human individuals have had their mitochondria sequenced, and we've never ever seen this Neanderthal haplotype in any modern humans. So that was the story of the mitochondria, but it is a limited story. So the genome sequence came from these three bones, largely, that have been dated to about 40,000 years ago. One of them is a little bit older, this Vindhya 3325, and they all come from this Vindhya cave in Croatia, and they were unearthed in 1980 and have been sitting in a museum in Zagreb for most of the time that they were out of the ground until Svante went there and got them and started drilling holes in them and extracting DNA from them. So when we did this direct sequencing, which is something that's really revolutionized the field of ancient DNA, moving from PCR, trying to amplify a specific fragment in the mitochondria, to instead just taking all of the DNA, putting it in a library, and sequencing all of it, What we see is if we just take all the sequences that come off the sequencer and classify them based on sequence similarity, in a good case, in a good sample, just a few percent of the sequences are from the organism that first owned the bone, in this case the Neanderthal. Most of the sequences have their highest similarity to some soil living bacteria or don't have any statistically significant similarity to anything. So the big result from this is that mostly what you're getting are things you don't care about, and hopefully at least some of things that you do care about.
So when you say it's nothing, is that because it's been degraded? And why do you think that number, the no-hit, is so high?
Well, one thing, this can be thought of a bit as like a metagenomic sequencing project where you just go and get some seawater or dirt or something from somewhere that you find interesting and just sequence it. In these projects, it's often the case that a huge percent of the sequences don't look anything like anything.
So it's not any known until my sequence.
Right, yeah, and it's more a description of the incompleteness of sequence databases than it is anything about this. We could say more about these sequences if we did protein searching, but for this purpose, to classify it taxonomically, some remote similarity that can only be seen through translated sequence is probably not good evidence of having the right taxon in this case for classification. But this is really just to say that just a few percent of the sequences that we get we care about. And this is barrier number one, really, in doing a genome project from Neanderthal. Very little of what is recovered is of interest. Most of it is just this other stuff you have to plow through to get that. And the situation has gotten a little bit better on that. I'll describe one intermediate technology that we put into place, and maybe if people are interested, other things that could possibly be done for getting this number higher than just a few percent. So the sequences themselves, both the Neanderthal sequences and a lot of the microbial sequences that come from the bone are really short. They're fragmented, which is typical for ancient DNA. It gets shorter and shorter over time. There are strand breaks and the fragments just become shorter to the point that eventually they're not really sequenceable. You can't get them in a library. Excuse me. We have a lot of sequence data from the mitochondria, which is wound up being very useful. You can assemble this into finished quality mitochondrial sequence, which is a great thing to have because then you know the correct base at each position, and then you can turn around and look at the reads and say what kinds of errors are happening in ancient DNA and what do the sequences look like. You can also look at the 13 protein coding genes in the mitochondria and ask what changes happen here that are specific to all humans and separate us from Neanderthals, and likewise what happened in Neanderthals and separates us from humans. And this is an important point, I guess I can stress at this point, that having the Neanderthal sequence is not only useful for saying how Neanderthals were different, but it's also useful for saying how humans are different very recently. It gives us this really close outgroup and lets us put our finger, instead of on all of these changes that separate us from chimp, on just these very recent changes that even separate us from Neanderthals that happened in recent evolutionary time. We found one gene, this COX-2, that has four of these differences where the human and the Neanderthal are different, and the Neanderthal is like the chimp, meaning that each of these four changes happened very recently, even since humans separated from Neanderthals. But these, it turns out that this, one might think, well, that's a really interesting gene with all of these changes that are very recently, happened very recently. But the none of them are really, because the structure is known not only of this gene, but this entire complex, and there's a lot known about where the business end of this is, all the chemistry happens here at this copper center. All of these changes are kind of far away from this interesting biology, this interesting chemistry, and these positions are even fast evolving sites. If you go out far enough in phylogeny, you even see what happened very recently in human also exists in cow or baboon in this case. That what we're picking up here, it looks like, are just fast evolving sites. So this is a bit of a cautionary tale that if one looks for lots of changes very recently, one can often find fast evolving sites and not necessarily something that is important evolutionarily. To really answer this question, for a good candidate or a bad candidate or any candidate, you would want to go in and do some biochemistry and ask, is the activity of this actually any different? Does this confer some selective advantage? If so, but this is less an interesting candidate because we know these are fast evolving sites and they're away from this functional center here. Okay, so we also get to see what kinds of errors happen in ancient DNA, and this was known a bit already. There are lots of C to T differences and G to A differences. All of the other differences happen just at the background rate of the sequencing machines make these errors. The C to T and G to A, we know this is cytosine deamination, becomes a uracil, and it's read as a thymidine by the polymerases that are used for sequencing. Turns out that they're occurring in this interesting spatial pattern. C to T changes happen really frequently at the very first position of these ancient reads. And G to A happens really frequently at the very end. So if the first base in a Neanderthal fragment was a C, there's about a 40% chance that we will read that as a T. There's a really high error rate. And then it falls down as you go towards the interior. The model for why this is the case is that the breaks that happen in ancient DNA as it's becoming fragmented are not clean double-stranded breaks, but rather single-stranded breaks. And when you get single-stranded breaks on opposite strands of the chromosome that are close enough, they will dissociate, and then you'll wind up with these sticky ends, single-stranded ends of fragments. And it's known that the rate of cytosine deamination in single-stranded DNA is several orders of magnitude higher than it is in double-stranded DNA. So these single-stranded regions at the very beginning of each read are very labile. They become uracil much more quickly. And this is the distribution, probably, of the lengths of these single-stranded overhangs. Nearly all of them have at least one base pair, and then fewer and fewer have longer single-stranded overhangs. So this G to A at the end, it's the mirror image of C to T at the beginning. This happens because when you generate a library, there's a polymerase fill-in step to polish the ends of the reads. And at the 3' end, this fill-in step, if there's an internal nick, the polymerase that's used is called BST polymerase. It starts polymerizing downstream from a nick. And ordinarily, this is used to fill in the adapter sequence where there's only one strand that's ligated. But if there's an internal nick in the fragment, which there often is in these ancient DNA fragments, it will fill in downstream of that. And then if there's a deaminated cytosine on the other strand, it reads that as a template, and opposite of what used to be a C and is now a uracil will be read as a T. You'll get the reverse complement of that, an A. So what used to be a G opposite a C and then a uracil is now an A opposite a uracil. So you get the exact mirror image at the 3' end of what's going on at the 5' end. Understanding the biochemistry of all of this and how this interacts with the library generation process is perhaps interesting, or perhaps not interesting. but this is really important for having a quantitative model of what to expect, because then you can then accurately detect Neanderthal sequences and align them if you know to expect, for example, that 40% of the C's are going to be read as T's at the beginning of a read. Okay, so we sequenced a few complete mitochondria since that day, the early days of this, and get some picture from the mitochondria of the population genetics of Neanderthal. And that's shown in this tree here that we can make from the whole mitochondrial sequences. Here is a comparison of 54 different human complete mitochondria from different language groups with the 6 complete Neanderthal mitochondria that we have from these sites here. And if you're used to looking at these trees, you know the total branch depth here to this internal node is proportional to how much sequence diversity there is here. A longer branch means more changes on that branch. So you can see this internal node where all humans come together is much deeper than this internal node where all Neanderthals come together. Now, granted, there are more humans here. There are 54 sequences here and only 6 here. but we have a pretty wide sample of a geographic range and even a wide sample of a temporal range going back 60 to 70,000 years for this Mesmaiska sequence. So what one could infer from this is that the sequence diversity within Neanderthals as a population was really low, even compared to humans, where it's already really, really low. Humans have an effective population size that is much lower than, for example, chimpanzees. There's a lot more sequence diversity. If you pick any two chimpanzees, they have about 10 times the sequence difference as picking any two humans. But we're already kind of low on this scale, and Neanderthals are even lower than us, it appears. And this, one can speculate about why this may be the case, but they did live through several ice ages, and it's likely that they would have population crashes, and this would impact the effective population size, the long-term effective population size. But for right now, it's just an observation. The complete sequences that we have show very little sequence diversity. Okay, so I'll describe the way that we pump this up, this intermediate method. It's a very simple thing. When we make the sequencing libraries, you put an A and a B adapter on all of the reads that are all of the sequence fragments that come out of the bone. And this A and B adapter are necessary for amplifying each read, either in emulsion PCR if it's 4x4 or by bridge amplification on a slide if it's Selexa sequencing. But they both must be there, the A and B adapter. And what we did then was take the sequencing libraries and digest them with this cocktail of restriction enzymes. So cut up the sequencing libraries with these restriction enzymes. And these are the restriction sites for these restriction enzymes. And this is the percent of either the Neanderthal sequence or these common other categories that we don't want that would be cut by each of these restriction enzymes. So we took some of our early run data and asked what restriction enzymes cut the least amount of Neanderthal and the most amount of other things. And it turns out that there are a handful of restriction enzymes that really cleanly partition these two, that hardly cut the Neanderthal things at all and cut these other guys like crazy. The feature that they have for the most part is this CG dinucleotide, which you probably know is the least common dinucleotide in the human genome and a lot of mammalian genomes, because this C gets methylated often, and there is a very special mutagenic process that goes on where it quickly becomes TG, and over evolutionary time we've lost most of our CGs to become TG. So in our genome, CG just hardly occurs. And if you pick these restriction enzymes that mostly cut CG, CG is not special at all in bacterial genomes. It cuts those guys up like crazy and hardly touches the Neanderthal sequences. So you can, after you've done this digestion, enrich the library such that about 1/5 of them are Neanderthal DNA, which is really good. But it has a real practical implication then for the data that we get. Sites in the Neanderthal genome that are rich in CG, where it does cut, are gone. So this winds up disallowing or hindering some types of analyses. For example, looking at certain repeat classes like ALU elements that do have some of these restriction sites, those are their representation in our sequence data is not at all what the representation was in the original sequencing library. So it's important to keep in mind, this was a kind of intermediate technology for pumping up the amount of Neanderthal data that we get.
It'd be hard on your promoters too.
Yeah.
CPG islands are also mostly gone. So
do you see that you have a dearth of sequencing promoters?
Yeah, in fact, we implemented this kind of early on in the project, but we had already collected a lot of data before it was implemented, and had many hundred of fold coverage from two of the bones in the mitochondria. These sites also exist in the mitochondria where this entire process is not there. You don't have methylation at CPGs in the mitochondria, so CGs occur in the mitochondria a lot. And we don't even have, despite the having, you know, on average maybe 800 fold coverage of the mitochondria, we don't have a complete mitochondria of Vindi 3026, because those restriction sites, the coverage drops from 800 down to zero.
Mm-hmm.
You know, restriction enzymes work really
right,
well.
Yeah.
If that restriction site's there, it'll cut. On top of that, if you want to get depressed about this even more, the cytosines that are methylated and deaminated, if you take a cytosine and deaminate it and methylate it, that is a thymine. So methylated CBGs are not CBGs at all, they're TPGs. And restriction enzyme whose site includes a CG won't cut a TG. So methylated CBGs at these restriction sites do pass this filter, but pass with the wrong sequence. So that is another gotcha to be aware of in the data. But that's also in this background of a high C to T difference. One should never trust an ancient DNA base that says T where something else has a C. There's a high rate of C to T, and this is just more of that, in a special case of more of that. Okay, so the data that were generated, a little over a gig from each of these three bones. We also generated a smattering of data from a bone in Spain, the type specimen Feldhofer from Germany, and this Mesmeiska bone that is a little bit older than the other two. And a little over one fold coverage of the genome. We, from this, estimated the average divergence across the genome between humans and Neanderthals by aligning this to the chimpanzee and then counting the number of differences that were specific to the Neanderthal or the human or to the chimpanzee. And one can then find the ratio of differences that are here versus those that are here and ignore all the ones that are here, which are dominated by G to A and C to T. Just ignore this branch entirely and infer or assume that this branch length is roughly equal to this branch length and ask how far back is this internal node as a function of this total difference here, back to the common ancestor with chimpanzee. And it turns out that this is about 12.7%. We only use transversions to measure this because these are more reliable. It throws out C to T, T to C, G to A, and A to G. Where it's possible to misinfer things because of the weirdness of ancient DNA. So just using transversions, here are the counts. And each of these three bones, 16, 25, and 26, is nearly the same divergence back here. So to put this in some context, if you pick your favorite time for human and chimpanzee divergence, maybe 6.5 million years, then this corresponds to about 825,000 years. Which is the time that the difference between a human and any one of these Neanderthals, the difference in their genome when that was born, when that mutation happened. Okay, so what that is not, is very important, it's not the time that humans and Neanderthals split, the population split, the group of people who would become Neanderthals left Africa and colonized Eurasia. It is not that at all. Instead, it's the time that the genetic difference, on average, was born between a human and a Neanderthal. And an analogous thing to, I guess, mention about this to help understand it, if it's not clear, is one could pick any two people in this room, and there would be genetic differences between those two people. Those differences were born at some time in the past. At any place in your genome, you have a common ancestor with anybody else. And back at that common ancestor, once you have split, then you start accumulating differences. This is the time, on average, that you have a common ancestor with somebody else in your genome. This number is when you have a common ancestor, on average, with a Neanderthal, about 825,000 years ago. For two humans, this number is, on average, about 400,000 years, but it really depends on which two humans you pick. For Neanderthal, it doesn't matter so much which two humans you pick, with one caveat that I'll get into in a minute. This 825 is kind of a landmark number. It's the time that we have a common ancestor on average, an average part of our genome with a Neanderthal. The 6.5 million years for chimpanzee, if this is not clear already, this distinction between when the population that would become human and the population would become chimpanzee split, and when the average genetic divergence is between human and chimpanzee, it's about the same number. The time that you've had to do lineage sorting, the 6.5 million years, is so small compared to how long ago this common ancestor lived, that doesn't really matter anymore. whereas for humans and Neanderthals, it was so recent that that actually dominates the this figure, the average genomic divergence. So I won't talk about the analysis, but you can ask the other question, how long ago did the populations that became Neanderthals and the population that became humans, how long ago did they split? That number is about 300,000 years, but it's more difficult to infer, and it requires assuming something for the average generation time, which we really don't have a good idea about over historical times. But if you say that this is about 20 years, then about 300,000 years ago, the populations diverged, and their genetic difference was born a little over 800,000 years ago. Okay, so I think I've belabored that enough. This divergence, which is about 12.7% on average to each of these three Neanderthals, it differs across the genome. There's some places where it's much deeper and some places where it's shallower. We also did shotgun sequencing to about six-fold coverage from these five individuals, or five individuals from these groups, for comparison. And one can compare the divergence to the reference genome, the human reference genome, to each of these five individuals. Then this is what it looks like. Each one of them is on average more shallow and has a tighter distribution of divergences than each of the Neanderthals. There's a deeper on average and this longer tail to the Neanderthal, and we're really curious about what's going on in that tail, but I don't have anything terribly solid to say about that right now. Another thing that one can do that turns out to be really interesting is take the human reference genome and partition this into regions that are inferred European ancestry and regions that are inferred African ancestry. And the way that one does this is to look at the backs that went into the human reference genome and that comprise the human reference genome. And one of these back libraries, RPC11, I think, is inferred to be an African American who has ancestry from both Africa and from Europe. And so for each of these backs, one can then ask, is this a back, is this a haploid sequence that came from a place where it's confident to say this individual was of European ancestry or of African ancestry, using known variation in Europeans and Africans today? And one can then, for the entire human reference genome, say this is European ancestry or African ancestry, or for a lot of it, say, I don't know, it's not clear, or it came from a different back library and it's not inferable. But for the bits that are confidently inferable, one can then say, does it matter if I'm comparing the divergence to the European bit of the reference or an African bit of the reference? And it turns out it does. The Neanderthals have a slightly shallower divergence to the European bits of the human reference than they have to the African bits of the human reference. So they're a little bit more similar to the parts of our reference genome that are of European ancestry than those that are of African ancestry. If you do the same thing with these five modern human samples, there is a much bigger difference. All of the non-Africans have closer similarity to the non-African or the European bits of the reference, especially the French guy. He's probably closely related to the, or more closely related to the European whose parents were in RPC11. And the Africans show less difference between European and African segments, probably reflecting the deeper coalescences within Africa in general. So this is suggestive of something. It's suggestive of not a clean population split from Neanderthals and all humans, which was the model that we had in mind when we did this in the first place, informed largely from the mitochondrial sequence, that Neanderthals split off. At the time that they split off, there were no Africans or Europeans or Papuans or anything. There was no human population differentiation. Humans had not even come into existence as we know them at that time. And then later, they came into existence and colonized the world and did whatever population differentiation they have done. Under that scenario, the Neanderthal should be equally related, equally divergent to any part of the reference human genome, and that's not what we see. Okay, so we wanted to investigate this more directly, and one thing that we did was look at all pairwise comparisons amongst the five humans that we sequenced and find regions where two humans differ from one another. Find all the regions where two humans, the two that are under investigation, differ from one another. So for example, here, this French guy has a G in this read, and the Yoruban at that position has a T. And then ask, what does the Neanderthal have? Under this model of a clean split of Neanderthal before any human populations have come into existence, the Neanderthal should match both of these with equal probability. It should be 50-50. And so we did all of these pairwise comparisons, and it turns out that it is 50-50 if you're comparing two Africans, the San and the Yoruba, for example, or any two non-Africans. But if you compare any African with any non-African, there is a slight but statistically very significant excess of the Neanderthal matching the non-African, which is consistent with admixture between Neanderthals and non-Africans. What's interesting about this, almost shocking about this, is that this signal exists just as much in Papuans as it does in French. Papua New Guinea is not a place where Neanderthals are known to have been. In fact, it's pretty clear that they never were there. This is in very far in Oceania, and would have been quite a story if you ever found a Neanderthal fossil there. It's way outside their known range. In fact, it's why we picked Papuans in the first place to sequence for this. It has something of a negative control. But we see this signal of Neanderthal admixture in Papuans just as much as the other non-African samples. So the picture from that pairwise comparison is that any Africans, or the two that we sequenced anyway, are equally similar when you compare them to the Neanderthal, and any non-Africans are equally similar. But any comparison between the two groups, there is excess of matching to the non-Africans. Okay. Another analysis, and sorry for the fuzziness of this slide, that we did to investigate this admixture question was also relying on the ability of to partition the reference genome into European and African segments. And what is shown here is the human reference versus Neanderthal divergence, normalized by the human-chimp divergence, and where one is just the average divergence that you see between the two. So here, the human reference and the Neanderthal are really similar, and out here, they're very divergent. And of course, you have a wide range of this just by stochastic depth of the gene tree. But these regions here, where there's really high similarity, if there is admixture, then these should be enriched for regions that are admixed. There should be, if there are some regions of the genome that came in from Neanderthals, they should be really close between Neanderthals and the reference, and they should be in the European bits of the human reference sequence. So then what's shown on the y-axis is the human reference divergence to Craig Venter, whose genome we have also, at the same place where you have this human to the Neanderthal divergence. So there's a clear difference in what's going on if you're looking at a European segment or an African segment. In the African segments, the behavior is just as one would expect. If the human is close to the Neanderthal, the reference human is also close to Craig Venter. These are places where the gene trees are just shallow and everybody's kind of close to one another. On the other hand, if it happens to be a European part of the reference genome and the reference human is very close to the Neanderthal, then the reference human is really divergent from Craig Venter. And the model then, the model then to explain this is that in these segments, or in many of these segments, the human reference, which at that point is of European ancestry, actually is of European, but further back, Neanderthal ancestry. And what you're looking at here is Craig Venter to Neanderthal ancestry, which then goes very deep, which not only is consistent with this admixture in some parts of the human reference, but also consistent with not every non-African having the same bits of Neanderthal ancestry. So in the bits where the human reference is European / Neanderthal, Craig Venter is not, and therefore his divergence is really deep. It's human / Neanderthal divergence.
But isn't Craig Venter European?
Yes, he is European. But presumably, he has Neanderthal ancestry, but at different parts of his genome. All of I'll show on the next analysis, but all of the picture that we have now is that this Neanderthal ancestry that we can pick up, we think is 1 to 4% of the genome, is different parts of the genome for everyone who has it, the non-Africans who have this. So the bits that one person might have are different bits than someone else might have. And at least for the bits that we've been able to localize, they're haplotypes that are rare. That if you happen to have Neanderthal ancestry there, chances are even other non-Africans don't. They're rare haplotypes. Okay, so finally, the last analysis that we did was this haplotype-based analysis. And this was something that was conceived and implemented by Rasmus Nielsen up the road. And they used this HapMap2 data that is phased to then make haplotype trees of the Han Chinese and Sef Europeans and Yoruba in this panel. And what you typically see when you do this is that the deepest divergences in this haplotype tree usually, or in many cases, separate Africans from non-Africans or Africans either exist just on one side of this or exist in all of this. And this is the basic picture of human genetic diversity. Most of the sequence diversity in the world is just within Africa. The deepest trees are there, and the genetic diversity that exists outside of Africa is mostly a subset of what you see within Africa. So this is the normal situation here, but occasionally you can find regions of the genome that look like this, where you have the deepest divergence in haplotypes separates a clade that only exists outside of Africa, so only has non-Africans. And then this other clade has some Africans and some non-Africans. But this very deep thing here then is a candidate for introgression. Perhaps this came in at some point from Neanderthals and only exists outside of Africa now because Neanderthals only existed outside of Africa, or only known to exist outside of Africa. So it turns out, if you find the 12 strongest examples of this, where this divergence is the deepest, and you have this cladal structure, in 10 out of 12, the Neanderthal matches this non-African haplotype. And in each of these cases, the non-African haplotype is rare. On average, it is 15% of the population of the non-Africans that it occurs in. So it would be very, very rare to even find a modern human who had 10 out of 12 of these haplotypes. Yet the Neanderthal data that we have has 10 out of 12 of them, which indicates that they, or it's strongly suggested that they came from Neanderthals. So the picture then that we are left with is this one here, that Neanderthals split at some time in the past, and then there was some subsequent contact, probably when humans first left Africa and encountered Neanderthals in the Middle East. Later, humans colonized the rest of Eurasia and picked up this genetic contribution from Neanderthals and spread it in roughly equal amounts amongst all non-Africans now. This is in contrast to the model that the last holdouts of multi-regionalism had, that you would expect to see this admixture signal only in Europeans today. We don't see it only in Europeans. We see it in all non-African people today. So probably, by parsimony, it happened early on here. We would love to be able to say something about this, perhaps a genetic interaction between some earlier form in Neanderthal, but it's we're still trying to figure out how to do that, and if one has any great ideas, I would love to hear it. There are these deeply diverging regions of Neanderthal and the reference human. They're a really wide distribution, but so something to think about. And of course, what we still battle against trying to exclude is this model here, where there could have been some population structure within Africa at the time Neanderthal split off that was maintained all the way to the time that humans migrated out of Africa, and the same subpart of this structure that would become Neanderthals also came out and became humans here. That's still a formal possibility that it's really hard to exclude. Okay. So here's the picture. Probably early on, humans encountered Neanderthals. There was some admixture, and then they took it in roughly equal proportions to the rest of the world. Okay, so there's not a clock in here, is there?
Wow.
10 to 3.
Okay, so in the last 10 minutes or so, I want to talk about the main thing, which is this using the Neanderthal to find positive selection in humans. And to motivate this a little bit, there's a set of slides that I love to talk about. This is the typical technology from Neanderthals, a hand axe, which you find in it's diagnostic of a Neanderthal site. They love to make these things, this bifacial hand axe. And it's pretty nice technology, I guess, for chopping up things and getting meat off of bones. But it's very different from what Neanderthal contemporaries were doing, our ancestors, our modern human ancestors, making this what we still recognize today as art, and compared to our technology today. It leaves the picture that there probably were some cognitive differences between Neanderthals and humans. And these cognitive differences probably have some biological and genetic basis. And we can, once again, abuse the Neanderthals and use them, perhaps, to find the regions of our genome that underlie these biological differences. So this using the Neanderthal fills a really frustrating hole in looking for positive selection, important evolutionary changes in our history. And this hole exists between the current methods that can tell us what happened in the last 6 million years, where we're different from chimpanzee. It can also tell us what happened in the last few hundred thousand years by looking at extant human diversity, the sequence differences that exist between one human and the next. But there's a big gap there where a lot of important evolution happened that is currently a gap without the Neanderthal. So just shown another way, there are a lot of methods that are generalized here for looking at the sequence of some outgroup in the chimpanzee and human, and identifying regions where there are lots of differences on this one lineage. And these differences can be nucleotide substitutions, or they can be non-synonymous differences normalized by synonymous differences, or any type of change where you can get an expected rate and then ask, do we see too many in humans here? But even when you see too many in humans, the temporal resolution of this is only sometime in the last 6 million years, stated more precisely, on average, in the last 6 million years, too much stuff has been going on here, so it's probably interesting. But when exactly that happened, it's hard to say. Likewise, if you want to say what happened very recently in humans, there are a lot of different methods for doing this. You can look for haplotypes that are in linkage disequilibrium, some region of the genome where lots of humans have high linkage disequilibrium, and compare against other populations, for example, and say what happened in the last few hundred thousand years since this population diverged from this population. But these don't allow you to go back very far in the past. If you're just looking at LD, then you're really looking at the time since human populations diverged, which is about 80,000 years ago. And there are some other methods looking at frequency spectra, for example, that are a little more powerful for seeing further in the past, but there's a real limitation in how far back in the past you can see using data that only is in people who are living today. So the idea now for using the Neanderthal is a combination of using the Neanderthal and extant human polymorphism data, so you get a lot of humans and find where they're different. And then one can generalize this here as the colored bars. These are places that are still segregating polymorphisms within humans. Two humans might be different from each other at each of these positions. And then, because we know that Neanderthals and humans, this population divergence was about 300,000 years ago, and the average genetic divergence was 800,000 years ago, at this time, this population, 300,000 years ago, that wasn't human and wasn't Neanderthal, what was segregating in that population is largely what is still segregating today in us and was still segregating in Neanderthals up to the time when they went extinct. So a lot of this history is just frequencies changing at these sites that were already polymorphic here. And the same thing in humans. Unless there was some evolutionary event, some important change that conferred a selective advantage. When that happens, a selective sweep is what it's called, and you temporarily wipe the slate clean of diversity. The one variant that confers some advantage comes higher in frequency, and if it's a hard sweep, it goes to fixation. And linked to it, all of the variation that was linked to it also becomes fixed. So at some time, you have reduced or no diversity within that region. But if it's long enough ago in the past, then new mutations will arise and come higher in frequency, such that this region, given enough time, won't look special anymore. This history of what happened back there in the past will be gone, because new mutations are there. And you still see polymorphic sites, you still see a frequency spectra that doesn't look weird, and you would have no clue that that was the gene for writing poetry that came into existence back then. So this is a sad story if you only have data from this side, but if you can compare the human and the Neanderthal sequence, because all of these differences came into existence after we split from Neanderthal, they're not sites that were polymorphic in that common ancestor. So if you ask, what is the Neanderthal allele at sites that are polymorphic in humans now, at these places, it will always be ancestral, because in fact it was never polymorphic. It's always like what the chimp had, always ancestral. So that's the crux of the idea for using Neanderthal to identify positive selection. And maybe spelled out a little more explicitly here, if in a typical part of the genome, we have sites that are segregating that derive back from this common ancestor and will be seen in the derived form in both humans and in Neanderthals. But if there is this beneficial mutation that comes to fixation, at some point you don't have any diversity, and then later diversity comes back into existence. But all of the polymorphic sites in humans, including, importantly, the beneficial mutation, will differ between, or be in the derived state when you compare humans with Neanderthals, if you can get Neanderthal sequence. Okay, so we have put into practice a kind of rudimentary form of this screen, looking for positive selection in humans. And in order to do this, what we're looking for is some region of the genome where polymorphic sites in humans, sites that are polymorphic in humans today, are seen in the ancestral form in Neanderthals. This is hard to, I should say it a different way. At any site that's polymorphic within humans, chances are you'll see it in the ancestral state in Neanderthals. Also, chances are you'll see it in the ancestral state in any human that you pick. It's just a description of the frequency spectra of polymorphic sites. Most polymorphic sites are ancestral in any human. The frequency, the derived allele frequency of any polymorphic site is really low. Chances are it's less than 50% for most polymorphisms. Stated another way, if you don't like that, is that most polymorphisms are rare. What has been seen with the human genomes as they have been sequenced, more and more new human genomes, about 10% of polymorphic sites are not something that has been seen before. And that number has been really stable. There's some huge percentage of polymorphism that you see in a new human who's been sequenced that's already in dbSNP or was something that was known before, and that number is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, but this category of things that are completely new to a new human that you sequence is pretty stable at 10%. This just says that some huge fraction, some huge component of polymorphism that's segregating within us, or really within any population, is really rare. Unique to you or your family or your shallow in your genealogy. Okay, so this is what we're up against. If we want to know, is there some region in the genome where Neanderthals always have ancestral? Well, we need to form an expectation for how many ancestral alleles we expect to see in Neanderthal, and it turns out that's a lot. So a first step toward this is saying, is there any relationship between the derived allele frequency in humans and the chance that we'll see an allele in the derived state in Neanderthal? So this is, on the x-axis, the derived allele frequency in our five humans plus the reference human, and then how often we see sites at that derived allele frequency in the derived state in Neanderthal. And the answer to the question is yes, there's a really good relationship. The more humans have a derived allele at a certain position, the more likely it is that you'll see the Neanderthal with that position in the derived state. This tells us very clearly that the allele frequencies of polymorphic sites today, as they're segregating in people, is closely related to the allele frequency back in the common ancestor of human and Neanderthal. So things that are high frequency today were mostly a high frequency back then, and then chances are the Neanderthal had it in the derived state too. Okay, mm-hmm. So that is a really important fact on the ground that we have to work with. So if we happen to be looking at a region of the Neanderthal genome where all humans have low frequency derived alleles, there are hardly any derived alleles, then we'll see hardly any derived alleles in Neanderthal too. And we don't want to fool ourselves and say, look, hardly any derived alleles here, it must be some positive selection. Nope, we expect to see few derived alleles there because the human gene trees are shallow. All the polymorphic sites are not often seen in derived state. So you can do the same thing for Craig, and the human frequency is even more predictive of Craig because he, as far as we know, is a human. So 80% of humans have a derived allele, there's an 80% chance that Craig will be in the derived state. Okay, so one can go one step farther and ask, is there any difference in information between each of these humans, the reference, the San, the Yoruban, the Han, the Papuan, or the French? Is it more important to see a polymorphic site in the derived state in the San, for example, versus the Han Chinese? And it turns out that you can see each one of these is a configuration of ancestral and derived alleles. This is at 50% frequency, so each of these has, each of the rows here has half yellow derived and half black ancestral, the different configurations for having that. If you have Han, Papuan, and French, all ancestral and the other guys derived, it's way more predictive that the Neanderthal will be derived than if it is exactly the opposite. So the particular humans that have a derived allele matter a lot, and you can get an even more accurate expectation for what you should see in Neanderthal if you keep track of which human has a derived allele. The reason that's the case, the reason that there's more data for the reference is a bit of a pain in the butt artifact thing of mapping, that we more sensitively find sequences that match the reference because we're aligning things against the reference. The San and the Yoruban carry more information because, as I said, in general, gene trees are deeper within Africa. And if you want to probe what was segregating in this common ancestor of human and Neanderthal, you need a deep gene tree, and you get more of those from these African guys than you do from the non-African guys. They went through a bottleneck. The non-Africans went through a bottleneck, and this reduces the depth of the gene trees. So we put all of this into a method for calculating how many derived alleles we should expect to see in Neanderthal, and then look for regions that are depleted. Another thing that we're, I have a protocol question. I'm over time.
Go ahead.
We have the room till 3:30, Stephen.
Okay, do we have your attention until 3:30?
Sure.
Okay,
yes.
All right. So another thing that we were up against, and it turned out to not matter so much, but I'll go through it because it's important to think about, was the recombination rate across the genome. This is something that differs over at least four orders of magnitude, how often you get a recombination event. This is, the reason that I'm bringing this up now is there was very recently an observation that the recombination rate is related to the depths of the gene trees across the genome. There's a really good relationship between how deep the gene trees are in humans and what is the local recombination rate there. And why this should be the case is still not completely nailed down, but it's thought to be, or one idea is that it's an effect of rampant purifying selection across the genome. That when you get a variant in some region that's conserved, we say something's conserved because it doesn't change very much. What that means is the people or the haplotypes that come into existence that do try to change that are less fit, and those haplotypes and alleles are eliminated from the population over evolutionary time. This reduces the effective population size in that part of the genome. they're less segregating variants over evolutionary time because many of them are destined for extinction, that variant will go out of existence. So if you, the idea then is if you're closely linked, genetically linked, to a region that's under purifying selection, then a lot of the variants that are coming into existence there are getting out of the way. And what does it mean to be closely linked? Well, that's a function of the recombination rate. If the recombination rate is really, really slow, if you never get a recombination event over huge numbers of megabases, then maybe you're far away from this event or this region that's under purifying selection. But the gene tree over that whole region is going to be depressed. On the other hand, if you're in a region that has high recombination, then you can quickly get yourself away from this region that's under purifying selection, and the gene trees can then go deeper. So the observation is there's this correlation between the depth of gene trees stated by the frequency spectra or the amount of heterozygosity in a region and the recombination rate. Okay, so I looked at this myself with the five humans that we have to see if this is a phenomenon in our data that we might need to take care of. And it turns out that if you bin our five humans plus the reference into sites where between 0 to 2 out of the 6 have the derived allele, or between 1/3 and 2/3, or between 2/3 and 5 out of 6 having the derived allele, and then ask how many you see, what is this derived allele frequency spectra at really kind of low resolution as a function of the local recombination rate, the recombination rate where these guys live. There is a really good correlation between recombination rate. This is from a low recombination to high recombination. The at really low recombination, you have lots of, most of your alleles are really rare in this rare category. And at high recombination, most of your alleles are in this higher frequency, or a higher percentage are in this higher frequency. So there's a lot of data here. One thing to take home if you've never seen stuff like this before, most polymorphic sites are in this rare class, as I just said. Most of the things that, most places where two humans differ are rare. And they're even more rare if you are in a region of low recombination, presumably because they're linked to some purifying selected sites that reduces the gene trees there. Okay, so this phenomena is easily observable even from sequencing five humans. And one could probably do a much better job of describing this quantitatively, but this is enough to let me know, is this something that we need to think about? Because this Neanderthal selective sweep screen stated yet another way, maybe with the figure here, really what we're looking for are places where the coalescent of all humans excludes the Neanderthal, or where human gene trees are so shallow that they don't include the Neanderthal. If there's something else going on, if some other phenomenon is happening that has nothing to do with positive selection at all, that reduces the depth of these human gene trees, we'll pick that up too. We'll also not see derived alleles in Neanderthals there and go ring the bell of positive selection, and it may not have anything to do with positive selection. So this recombination rate and derived allele frequency is also potentially ringing this bell. And so we looked at that, and then if you look at this relationship between derived allele frequency and how often you see the derived allele in Neanderthals, partitioned now by each of these recombination rates from low to high, this signal is mostly gone now. There may be something weird going on at really high recombination, some dependence at really high recombination, but if you were to draw a line, for example, between all of the black dots here, 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 and here, it wouldn't look so much different than the line that you would draw between all the red dots here. So the interpretation of this, if I haven't lost you yet, is that even though there's a relationship between recombination rate and the depth of the gene tree, where we have a deep gene tree, even if it's in a low recombination rate, it still tells us something about the Neanderthal sequence. So we have, in other words, less power to see positive selection when the gene trees are shallow. We're not seeing these really deep coalescences when the gene tree is shallow. But when we do, it still has power to find positive selection because it's still just as predictive of what the Neanderthal will have. Okay, so if we see a high frequency derived allele, even if it is in a region of low recombination, it's still predictive of what the Neanderthal will have. It's just that we see very few of these. There aren't many in this category, but when we see them, they're still predictive of Neanderthal. Okay, so it wound up being something that we can kind of work around in that way. So what we did was just build this model for looking across the human genome in windows and finding regions where we see fewer Neanderthal-derived alleles than we would expect. And we did some simulations. So this is the region width in Centimorgan that we identified, and this is how depleted, a statistical score for how depleted human is for, or the Neanderthal is for derived alleles at human polymorphic sites. And made a cutoff here that gets the top 5% of all the regions, and then did some simulations under different selection coefficients, either under selection or under neutral evolution, from five humans plus the reference. And what you can see is the selection are the red and orange guys, and the neutral evolution are the blue guys. Once you have a region that is appreciably wide in Centimorgans that is as depleted in Neanderthal-derived alleles as where we've set our cutoff, you're looking exclusively at real positive selection. Neutral evolution just won't generate a pattern like that. And this is, if you're familiar with screens for positive selection, nearly every method that exists now, every method that I'm familiar with, you have a huge overlap between what you would see in the neutral case and what you see in the selected case. It's really hard to get discriminatory power. And what we have here is extremely high discriminatory power. When it's a very powerful method when we see Neanderthals being depleted for derived alleles in humans. So what turns up in this screen? Well, first of all, I'll just say that you can compare what is in the tail of our distribution, that top 5%, versus the tail of these other distributions for positive selection. So what we did was take the regions that were identified by these guys and score them by our score. And mostly you get things that are centered around zero. They're not really extreme in our score at all. They're not things that have been seen before at all, which is perhaps not so surprising because they are probing a different time depth than what we're probing with our method. So this Carlson method was a frequency spectrum test that has a little more power to detect deeper things, and there is some overlap there. But even so, each one of these distributions is showing our score for the tail of their distribution. So it's largely new things that are turning up. And I'll talk about one of them, this gene RUNX2, that humans today, when they get a mutation in this, develop this cladiocranial dysplasia. That has this phenotype. There's a cranial phenotype, obviously, this thing called frontal bossing where the face sticks out, and the clavicles, the shoulders are misformed. They often don't close, and people who have this can touch their shoulders together. You get this bell-shaped rib cage, and weird things happen with the teeth. Frontal bossing looks like this. There's kind of a protruding face, forehead, and brow ridge, which is reminiscent of one of the differences between Neanderthals and humans that we really do know about, because we really do have their bones, and we can say in excruciating detail what the bones look like compared Neanderthal to human. And this CDD is a little reminiscent of this brow ridge that we see in Neanderthals. Likewise, this is what the X-ray rib cage of someone with CCD looks like. And this is a normal human. This is a normal Neanderthal, which has a bell-shaped rib cage compared to a human. So this, why this, if it's a true positive, why this should have been positively selected is still a mystery, but the phenotypic consequences perhaps are strongly implied by looking at the human mutant, or human mutants in this gene, RUNX2.
Is there any cognitive disorder associated with it?
Not that I'm aware of, no. I really don't know, though.
Are these loss of function mutations?
Yeah. Yeah, so why then, it's a little bit hard to keep in one's mind, but this is what a human looks like today when you have loss of function. Actually, this is haploinsufficiency in RUNX2, but a reduced function of RUNX2. Why Neanderthals would have reduced RUNX2 perhaps suggests what the, maybe the difference was in the promoter and they just expressed less of it.
Am I getting it right, though, that the loss of function has a phenotype that's more human-like, more modern human-like in the head, more Neanderthal-like in the ribcage, or did I get that backwards?
Well, it could be that. It could be that the human phenotype is actually gain of function in this, and when you lose function, you revert to this ancestral state, or it could be something more complicated. It's just, at this point, it's something that's worth talking about because there is all of this phenotypic description of the loss of function phenotype. Typically, if people want to know what a gene does, you can make a knockout in mouse, or you can do something to learn the phenotype. If you're really lucky, then you have, maybe lucky is not the right word, but a disease phenotype in human can be useful for investigating gene function. In this case, it's beyond useful. It's very suggestive of, maybe these differences were even positively selected somehow in humans.
But I thought it went the same way.
Yeah.
Jim was asking whether whether the reduced expression in human creates Neanderthal features both in the rib cage and in the brow, and it's or are they opposite directions?
No. It is both the all of these things are the phenotype of loss of function. So all of this is the phenotypic spectrum. Yeah,
creates more Neanderthal-like features.
Yes.
Well, it depends what you consider the frontal bossing. Maybe that's it. I'm interpreting the frontal bossing as being more human-like.
No, well,
never mind. We should go on. We're running late anyway.
Okay, sorry. All right, so one can also, because we have the Neanderthal data, we can not just look at how many derived alleles we see at polymorphic positions, but drill down in a real causative difference would be specific to humans, even compared to Neanderthals and not polymorphic in humans. This is another one of our top candidates. This turns out to be polymorphic in humans. It's segregating still at low frequency, but just for illustrative purposes, this is kind of what one might get if one looked for fixed differences that were specific to humans and differed to even all Neanderthals. And this eliminates many, many potential candidates for being the causative difference. And that's another real weakness in most scans for positive selection. They turn up a region. They say somewhere in this 2 or 3 megabases of genomic sequence, there's something that might be important, but I can't tell you exactly what position it is. This method potentially has a way to address that. And then finally, we can run this not only on, you need this particular configuration of populations, like Neanderthals and humans, where the gene trees are deeper than the population split. This exists for all the great apes. There are Eastern and Western chimps that have really, really deep gene trees and maybe a few 100,000 year population divergence. Same thing for gorillas, Eastern and Western gorillas, Bornean and Sumatran orangutans. If one could get diversity data from one or the other of those, one can run this method on any of them. And this could be useful because it was recently shown that a lot of the things that turn up in screens for positive selection in humans turn up in lots of primates. And if you really want to put your finger on what makes a human, it's probably not something that's making a Bornean orangutan also, although it may be, but that would be a useful data point to have. Okay, so there are some people who did a lot of the good work in this. David did a lot of the admixture analysis. Svante invented the project and invented the field and is the real visionary. Monty does a lot of the simulations, the population genetic stuff. This guy works in the lab and has the best hands in ancient DNA. And Adrian is another guy who works in the lab and is really funny and smart, and that's me. And that's it. Thanks for your attention, Sarkar. I really thought that was going to be half an hour.
So are there really no regions where most non-Africans are fixed to something that's Neanderthal-like? Can we kind of say that with confidence?
No, we can't say that at all. And in fact, that is on the slate of things to investigate next. The analysis that I talked about, that haplotype analysis, part of the selection criteria for that was that the haplotype that only existed outside of Africa and is the deepest diverging haplotype split had to be the minor haplotype in non-Africans. The reason for that was at that time we were still very worried about contamination, and we didn't want to pick a haplotype that was high frequency. Yeah, that you'd see all the time because most non-Africans have it. So we have not run this now with looking for common haplotypes. And specifically, I try to just rush past it and not think too much or be affected in any way by any of the political things. But
right.
Asking those kinds of questions, it gets harder and harder to do that. Ask for fixed differences that came from Neanderthal that separate all humans from or all non-Africans for Africans, and
right.
But I mean somebody's going to do this at some point, and once you find them, then you can start to ask about the biological consequences of it, and it I would just rather not ever have to deal with any of that stuff. Yeah. So,
Is it significant at all that it's such a small percentage and it's so non-uniform? It's like the Neanderthal.
Yeah.
It's because what you're essentially saying is that there's no one bit of Neanderthal that the humans like to keep, right?
Right. The signal. So one thing that is a data point that's related to both questions and is very important to point out, I think. People, before we had Neanderthal data, went looking for admixture, looking at human polymorphism. And one thing that you can look for is a very deep haplotype structure where one of the haplotypes only exists outside of Africa. And people found this. The microcephalin locus, for example, there's this tau locus on chromosome 17 where this, like a 1 megabase region, has done an inversion. And this suppresses recombination, so you get lots of differences that are perfectly linked because you never recombine the two haplotypes. And in both cases, there were papers that said this, and you had this weird geographic distribution that one of the haplotypes only existed outside of Africa or very low frequency within Africa. And people said this may have come from Neanderthals because this is exactly what we'd expect to see. In both of those cases, Neanderthal did not match the haplotype that was proposed to have come from Neanderthals. Maybe it came from a different Neanderthal or a different population, but it looks like there's not a lot of diversity between the populations.
Yeah, right.
So
it's very likely.
Yeah, we're very doubtful about that at all. So if there were some positively selected haplotype that came into humans from Neanderthals, we probably would have heard about it. It probably would have been identifiable before we ever got Neanderthal sequence. And the two that were proposed to fit the bill turn out to be wrong. So your question, is it significant that the most of the things that you see are rare? Well, one thing is that we only went looking for rare things now, but we're probably not going to find fixed differences, or at least over huge haplotypes that are easy to find. If there was a smoking gun, it would have been found.
That's really good.
Did scary a little bit that one mutation make human look so much like Neanderthal?
We know
there's been like
so much.
But it's a bone thing. Does it maybe make the bone last longer or something?
All of that, the phenotype of RUNX2 for the mutants of this, that phenotype is reminiscent of Neanderthal, was the case before we ever looked at Neanderthal genomic DNA. However interesting it is that there's one gene that you can reduce the dosage of and get something that is reminiscent of a Neanderthal is, that's just the phenotype of that CCD. That this gene shows up in our screen for positive selection is the new weird thing that one must explain. And what is odd about that, to me, to my mind, is that that difference, that morphological difference, would have conferred some selective advantage. How, you know, under even the simple case where you get this human form of this, and you reduce the brow ridge and the rib cage is human-like, how would that be positively selected? What selective advantage would that have conferred?
Could be hitchhiking or something, right?
Uh-huh. Could be.
Hitchhiking? Cold tolerance? I mean, it may not be that gene, maybe a gene that's next to it or something.
Well, we get pretty good power for spatial resolution for this. That one, I think there it included more than one gene. And I talk about RUNX2 because it's the one that kind of makes sense with the phenotype. But I think there's another gene that is within formally the region that turns off. Yeah. But then it would be, you know, you increase the number of genes that by one. And it's still pretty interesting that it's right next to this gene that has a phenotype that I'm not sure that you moved to the, oh yeah, I would have expected
yeah,
no,
but
that.
What are the odds of finding something interesting? I mean, it seems like you're always going to find something interesting.
Yeah, yeah, especially if your threshold for interesting is low enough. Yeah, you're right. And going through these lists of genes that turn up and you read things about them, and it's easy to, there's this psychological illusion that the right, everything is interesting in some way, and it's easy to start writing a story in one's head around things. You have to really watch that.
So what is the effective population size of neanderthals?
That is hard to say from the nuclear data that
what
we have.
What about the mitochondria?
For the mitochondria, it's a few thousand females. That's all we get an idea for. The pairwise sequence diversity between any two Neanderthals and the mitochondria is 8 on average, 8 segregating differences. Just pick 2 Neanderthal mitochondria on average, they'll have 8 differences. This is about what you see on average within just Europeans today. So the effective population size of Neanderthal women is about what you would have in just Europeans today. Across all of humanity, keeping in mind that most of the diversity exists only in Africa, the effective population size is about 10,000. So this is yeah, just a few thousand that we're talking about.
So why didn't you see this in the mitochondria? I'm still a little confused by why.
Yeah.
Does that mean the introgression happened in a certain direction?
There are a few answers to the question, I guess. One, the mitochondria, because it has a smaller effective population size, there's only one allele of that that matters per diploid genome, where there are two alleles that matter, one from your mom and one from your dad, and they'll all be inherited. Just the one from the mom matters. So it has 1/4 the effective population size of any other locus in the genome. So the gene trees are shallower, and they can tell us less about what has happened in the past. But this admixture that happened, if it happened, probably it was 80,000 years ago or so, the gene trees in our mitochondria are deep enough that we should see that. So perhaps it just drifted out of the population. Another potential explanation is that there was some positive selection, that our human mitochondria conferred some selective advantage, and we only see loci that were neutral. It didn't matter whether you had Neanderthal or human. And mitochondria is not one of those loci. Or it could be that there is some sex bias in the admixture, that there just were not so many mitochondria, but maybe more loci coming in, although we don't see any indication of that by looking at the divergence difference between the nuclear genome and the X chromosome, as one would expect. But it's kind of a mystery right now. The another data point that we would like to have is this 1-4% Neanderthal ancestry across the genome means also that 96-99% of the genomes of non-African have this recent African origin. Of course, the broad stroke of human demographic history is still the same. We recently came out of Africa from a very small population, all of us. It could just be that this mitochondria is a place where it happens to be that all humans, just by stochastic fluctuation, is a place that has that evolutionary story, like 96 to 99% of the genome of any individual has. It's just that all individuals happen to have that genealogy. But it would have been very useful to have seen this already in the mitochondria. It's, yeah, it makes a strong expectation that you then overturn. Yes.
Would you be looking at Y chromosome haplotypes next?
We have, I didn't go into contamination assays, but one of them is looking for Y chromosome sequence, which is by definition contamination because these are female bones. And the Cedrin sample that we have is a male, and the Felthoffer is a male, but they're both really poorly preserved samples, so we don't have a whole lot of data from the Y chromosome yet. We do know that the Y chromosome has an even shallower coalescence than the mitochondria in humans, and it's probably also the case in Neanderthals. So in terms of looking for introgression, unless there were, you know, large amounts of Neanderthal Y chromosome coming over, we probably wouldn't see that in humans now. And the Y chromosome is also just an absolute mess in terms of doing any kind of alignment or phylogenetics. It's a special case in nearly every, yeah, and there are enough people smiling at you.
So can you go back to sort of the story part of the divergence between humans and Neanderthals, where we're looking for, you know, what is it that gives us the ability to create these artifacts? Is there a story to be found here in the genome, right? You know, is the data there and we're just not seeing it? Is it that we need additional DNA from Neanderthal to find it? Is it, you know, where is where should we be looking? You know, obviously.
You've invited me to speculate a little bit, and I'll take the bait. So there were a few genes that showed up in these regions that are now, you can have defects in them and they're associated with autism. But there are lots of genes that are associated with autism. It's a really broad spectrum disorder. But it is a little bit suggestive also that so many of these things that appear to have been recently selected in humans, now when you have some inherited difference in this, that it can be linked to autism, presumably cause autism. And one idea that was there before we ever did the Neanderthal is that a component of the modern human cognitive phenotype is this behavior that is extremely non-autistic. Autism, one of the, you know, descriptions of this is that there is some deficit or some non-normality of social behavior. And specifically this ability to have an idea in your head of what's going on in someone else's head. That when you can do this well, then you are not diagnosed with autism. And when you have a problem doing this, then this is autism. And then there are lots of other things that go along with autism that's not really well understood. But if one imagines that one of the many differences between humans and the rest of the animal kingdom is that we can live in huge cities with millions of people and not, for the most part, kill each other and kind of get along and talk to each other and know what, be trained and know and even, you know, have some instinctive ability to know how to deal with other people, this is unique to humans. And perhaps this is something that evolved very recently and why these genes show up in our screen and really what separates us from Neanderthals. This is highly, highly speculative, but you know, the idea was there before, and this two-dimensional plot showing the region of the selective sweep screen and then the statistical score on the other axis. If you look at the outlier on the width of the region, which should be really proportional to the strength of the selection, there's this gene THOTA that probably has something to do with diabetes. We don't really know why.
Is that what gene?
THOTA, THADA.
You had this slide up.
Yeah, I don't know exactly why that would have been positively selected and or how interesting it is. If you look on the other axis, the gene that has the strongest statistical evidence for depletion of Neanderthal-derived alleles, it's a gene called AUTISM2 that is linked to autism. There's a translocation that breaks this gene, and if you have this, you are autistic. It's highly penetrant. And then there are several other genes in the top of our list that are linked to autism. So get back to the very beginning of your question, why we don't have the whole story now. Even the story may be there. It's a long process of identifying the candidate, finding the functional difference, proving that that really is different, and then saying how this impacts the downstream biology. But the list, I think, is, you know, where we are now, and going too far off that list and making stories is fun, and I like to do it. I like when people ask me the question, but it's, I guess that's where we are right now.
But how stable is the list? I mean,
not very
few, but I mean, it sounds like you're improving techniques, and that may
yes.
jostle the order of things on the list
yeah.
and bring some new things into light.
That is a great point. So the list itself is, we're looking at the tail of a distribution, and if you do anything to kind of jostle the distribution, then the tail is different also. One thing that, there's several things that should be done sooner rather than later. The biggest one is that in this screen, we were kind of following each of these analyses threads as the paper was being written. And the final verdict about admixture was not really in until the selective sweep screen was kind of done. And that result totally confounds our screen for positive selection, because what we're looking for is a deficit of Neanderthal-derived alleles. Under this model that Neanderthals split at some time ago in the past, and then, you know, whatever happened was independent on one side versus the other, but there was admixture. And we're using this French Han and Poplin, who we know have Neanderthal-derived alleles, for some other reason that's not positive selection or stochastic variation in the coalescent, it's admixture. And that's screwing us up. And there's an easy way to fix this. Just use African data, though we don't think they're involved in the admixture at all. So that is one thing on the drawing board, and there's a ton of data from any individual or any population that one would care about now. That makes the test more powerful.
Yeah, you could make the test more powerful, right.
Yeah.
Your null model, a lot of it was improving that null model about how many you would expect.
Exactly. And one day I will be able to crystallize my thoughts as succinctly as that.
Yes. Did anything show up in relation to speech and language?
I was going to talk about FOXP2, and there is this gene called FOXP2. Where inherited mutations have this phenotype that you have a deficit in speech and language, and also music and some other things to, you know, do with motor control. There, early on, just background for this, there was this test for positive selection looking at excessive derived alleles in humans that suggested that there was recent positive selection in humans about 100,000 years ago. And so this was something that we were really hot to look at early on in the Neanderthal. There's a piece of code running for the sequence reads as they come off the machine to find anything that might cover these two amino acid differences that separate humans and chimps, to know what this was in Neanderthal. It turns out, the surprise to everybody, that the Neanderthal is like the human in these. And this could mean that this positive selection was not on these two amino acid differences, or it could mean that the signal for positive selection is a false positive, or that it's on some nearby gene and has nothing to do with FOXP2. And, you know, which of these is true, we don't really know. But what we can say now is whatever advantage these two amino acids conferred was shared with Neanderthal too. Whether or not that means they can talk, it's a really hard thing to say. In Leipzig, this FOXP2 story kind of spawned a research group. There's a guy there, Wolfie Ehner, who is looking at using mouse models to explore FOXP2. He's made a knock-in mouse. You replace the endogenous mouse FOXP2 with either a humanized or a chimp version, and there is nearly no difference in these two mice except for in some ultrasonic vocalization. If you look at the little chirps they make when the pups try to find their mother, mice don't talk very much. I mean, they hardly make any sounds at all. But when they're pups, they'll call for their mother, and this call is different compared to the whether they have the human or the chimp version, which is a really hard thing to, I mean, you have to transform this sound into some wavelength that we can actually hear, and trying to say, okay, yeah, that sounds like a human sound. I mean, they make noise. It's really hard to interpret that phenotype and say whether it has anything to do with
speech. How is it in the whale? You
know? What's that?
In the whale.
What is FOXP2 in the whale? Is it?
Yeah. I don't know. It's a really highly conserved sequence, and the two amino acids that you have that differ between humans and chimps are highly conserved amino acids, but I don't know what it is in the whale. I think the bats that do this echolocation. Yes, there is some reason to believe maybe there's a different bats that do this and don't, different FOXP2 or something, but I forget the story, I shouldn't even brought it up. But in bats, there's some link to echolocation in FOXP2 too. So it seems to kind of broadly have something to do with speech or making sounds anyway. But humans and Neanderthals, as far as we can tell, were the same in this very important gene. And that kind of goes against this idea that was brewing that recently in human evolution, this great leap forward, there was something that happened, and that thing was language, and that's what let us be so different than everybody else. Although, you know, it's...
Could be another language gene.
Right, yeah, language is almost certainly not monogenic.
All right, let's thank Ed.